So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. And today we begin our program by taking kind of look at history here, the history of some of our most wondrous homes, about 20 of them, as a matter of fact, not about 20 of them is exactly right. And talking about history, you know, it's mostly about people in some ways. But this book that our authors, Karen Connolly and Louis Wasserman, have put together uses stories about people. The book is titled Wisconsin's Own. They use stories about people, where they come from, what they believed in, what they dreamed of, and what kind of homes they built. And they built some fantastic homes. So you have the Octagon home of the 1850s. We've got an Art Modern marvel of the 1930s. And I think the houses on the pages of this book really remind us of the richness of our Wisconsin heritage. Karen Connolly and Louis Wasserman are from Milwaukee. They're with me by phone today. They are the authors of Wisconsin's Own, 20 Remarkable Homes, published by the University of Wisconsin Press. They're graduates of Harvard University's Graduate School of Design, share an architectural practice, Louis Wasserman and Associates. And they have a couple other books, the previous books, Updating America's Classic Bungalows and Updating Classical America Ranches, and Cottage, America's Favorite Home Inside and Out. And they combined with the photographer Zane Williams to produce this book. And I'm telling you, the writing is wonderful. The stories about these books, about these homes, are wonderful. And Zane Williams' photography is just exceptional. It's a remarkable book, and I'm glad to be able to talk with them about it today and to let you in on the conversation. And you can join us as well. Take part yourself. Call us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Karen, Louis, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Larry. It's a pleasure.
And Larry, we appreciate this opportunity. However, Karen wanted to point out something, just a clarification for all.
Our publisher is the Wisconsin Historical Society Press.
Oh.
And I am old enough to remember Zane Grey, so I'm glad you brought him up.
I did correct that.
Well, we can work Westerns into this if you'd like. Now, the other thing, too, we should mention right up is that the Jeffress Foundation is responsible for this book more than anyone else. They were the ones that funded this effort, and they have been responsible for preservation efforts throughout the state. And we're just following in the wonderful good footsteps that they've provided for us.
Well, I tell you what, you've come up with an absolutely stunning book. Why did you want to put this one together?
Well, we, in our practice, we have a very small practice, and we've both been academicians, so we like to incorporate research into our architectural practice because we think it actually informs what we do. And with a real push now on sustainability coming to the fore, we were very curious about looking at older homes and seeing what practices they involved in their homes. And we decided the best way to learn about this was when we were offered this opportunity by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press, was to grab that opportunity and travel around the state and look back at the 150 years of the state and what people did.
I like the fact that you went around the state, and you could have picked probably 100 homes had you wanted.
Matter of fact, Larry, we looked at over, in fact, in the book we say 1,500, but in actuality, we probably looked at more than that. But we could have picked 20 on our drive from Sherwood to downtown Milwaukee.
I'm pretty sure of that. So I really like the fact that you really kind of represent the entire state. And that obviously was very intentional.
Well, that was part of the Jeffress Family Foundation. They support good architecture anywhere, But they do emphasize smaller communities. And so when they told us that, we were very excited, because when we moved to Wisconsin from the East Coast in the 1980s, Louis immediately got a grant to study small towns. And we spent after the first year we were here, we spent the summer traveling with a toddler and an infant around the state in a station wagon looking at small towns. And it affirmed our choice to move back to Wisconsin.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. I like small communities myself, and a lot of my research here at the University of Wisconsin involved working with smaller communities around the state, and they're lovely places, that's for sure. The book, I think, wouldn't be the treasure it is without Zane Williams' input here. How'd you happen to hook up with him?
Well, that was the Wisconsin Historical Society Press again. We like working with photographers, and they brought Zane Williams in, and we wrote the shot list for him, and then he interpreted it. And as you can see, the result is stunning.
Now seems a good time for me to talk about our integrative approach to our books, which is pretty typical of the first three, but especially of this book, where we think it's very important to integrate the various components that make this a great story. That means the write-up that Karen provides and the research she does, the supporting sidebars. Karen also writes the photo captions, which is a pretty important art.
Yes.
Because you have to, in 28 words or less, impart something very important. But couple that with these wonderful photographs that are, again, orchestrated like a Karen writes a shoot or shot list that describes how the particular shot is to relate to all the other elements, further reinforced and complemented by the drawings, elevations, and plans, which are pretty unusual for a book like this. But they're put together in a way that we intend and hope and are pretty sure we've been successful in making a complete and complementary part of elements that tell a really wonderful fabric of a story.
And, you know, I kind of like the way that you have you have sort of a thematic approach as opposed to a geographic approach.
We're not historians, so we, you know, the idea of
we have to say that several times. We're not historians.
But, you know, we don't think chronologically. We think, as designers, we think typological. So we link things by building typology. So when we looked at these different buildings, we thought about them as what, regardless of time frame, what do these buildings have in common? And if we group them, we can tell a fuller story about the architecture than if we went one by one. We also, hopefully, don't have to repeat ourselves if we do it. Architectural history was never my strong suit. I was always, you know, with the test said within 5 years, I was guessed the sixth year. So, but I got the gist of it.
But also something we call in our office and outside narrative architecture. This book is all about pulling out of these examples, out of our state's rich cultural and architectural history, a narrative that hopefully will not only entertain our audience, but also acquaint them, inform them, let them understand, and open the doors to a rich part of our history. And frankly, that's the approach that we take not only in our written research-related work, but also in our built work. We often have our clients, when they've commissioned us to design a home, we'll ask them to write a one- or two-page narrative of what it's like to come home to a house or a project we haven't designed for them yet, but hope to and are in the process of doing. And we use that narrative in turn to generate the ideas that become a home or a project.
Very interesting. Very interesting. I know our listeners are probably wondering and certainly interested in knowing the homes that you have selected and where they're located. Could you talk about that?
Well, boy, that's hard to do over the phone because I usually use the Wisconsin mitten and show all the different points. But basically, we go from Superior to Phelps to Neenah to Kohler, Milwaukee, Delavan, let's see.
Lake Geneva,
then Baraboo,
we go all the way across to La Crosse,
Madison,
Prairie du Chien.
So we try, oh, and Stout's Island, which is near Red Cedar Lake. So
but let's not forget Baraboo in the center of the state.
But we tried to get the whole mitten involved.
And Watertown was one too.
Yes.
Oh, definitely.
And we don't have anything in Door County, and we tried very hard to find one in Door County, but we found that to be sort of a special case.
Yeah.
With a couple of explanations.
Yeah.
One could be that Door County was developed, or at least the sort of significant homes that we were looking for came later.
Yes.
And maybe don't fit our timeline, or are still sort of, shall we say, closely held by the people that still enjoy them, and maybe they're not quite ready to share them with us.
Yeah. And you had a cutoff of, I think it was 1939, wasn't it? Why that?
Well, we cut it off there because, well, that's exactly halfway between the 150 years of the state from 1848 to 1939, which worked out well. And it's also before World War II. And after World War II, the architectural scene, especially in residential design, changes dramatically. So we thought that was a good point. And as I always like to chide our publisher, you know, there's always a second book.
Okay. Or a third or a fourth.
Well, tell me then how the architecture of the period that you exhibit in your book differs from the architecture after the war.
Well, there are a couple of ways to respond to that, but I think the most important thing is that we've done three previous books, and they were very specific either to style, but basically to housing type. But here we're looking at basically 20 homes of different styles, different periods, different materials. I mean, if there's one word that represents it, it's diversity, not only geographic but style-wise. People also ask often about style, and we've done a very good job of illuminating that in the sidebars. But frankly, as idea practicing with a firm that practices architecture and landscape architecture, what's more important than the particular style is the fact that these homes, these examples, transcend any particular style. They have wonderful examples of use of materials in relation to their site, proportion, material treatment. I mean, they're just beautiful, magnificent buildings, no matter what square you want to check off in terms of what style they're in.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking today with Karen Connolly and Louis Wasserman of Milwaukee. They are the authors of Wisconsin's Own 20 Remarkable Homes, published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press. And I tell you, it's a remarkable book. It's really fun to read the stories and to look at the wonderful photographs by Zane Williams. You may have a question about these homes or about the book. I hope you'll join in. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Karen Connolly and Louis Wasserman about their book, Wisconsin's Own, 20 Remarkable Homes, published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press. You can join us at 800-642-1234 with your questions and comments. What did you learn? I bet you did. Let me put it this way. What did you learn about Wisconsin and its architecture that maybe you didn't know before?
Well, our fast comment is, you know, enough to fill a 304-page book.
Yeah.
But we were really amazed because we weren't historians. And when we started to talk about or research the people in the book,
yeah,
how much the homeowners in Wisconsin during these years were well-traveled, well-read, well-educated, and really knew what was going on in the world. And Louis, why don't you talk a little bit about the World's Fair connection?
Well, in fact, one of the words that we keep going back to in describing this book is all the connections between the various owners, the fact that they innovated in their own particular field, shared those innovations, sold those innovations to the others. But one of the common bonds, I mean, that kept coming through in all of our research was the World's Fair. The World's Fair or fairs was this wonderful opportunity to share ideas and to disseminate information. The 1876 World's Fair was the World's Fair where the founders of Kimberly and Clark shared or rotated chairing the display that they had at Fairmont Park in Philadelphia. That's where Frank Lloyd Wright's mother probably saw the first example of Froebel blocks. That's where William Waters, I think, did Waters do the Wisconsin building at 1876, Karen, or at 1893?
I think it was 1893.
But in any case, Waters was one of the architects of, or was the architect of the Babcock House.
And Hearthstone.
And of Hearthstone. Hearthstone, which is in Appleton, was technically the first, some people would say the second, but we think the first house in the world to be electrified by the Edison method. They would have been definitely the first, except that they got a wire from Edison in New York saying that they had to wait, I think, 6 or 7 days so that he could electrify Cornelius Vanderbilt's house first. But the Pabst Mansion has this lovely appendage that was an exhibit that Pabst used at the 1893 World's Fair, and he moved to his home on Wisconsin Avenue. I mean, I think every single house has a wonderful connection.
And many of the estates in Lake Geneva, not the Wadsworth that we covered, but many of the estates brought pavilions from the 1893 World's Fair and installed them on their estates. But Wadsworth, the grounds were designed by the Olmsted brothers, whom there was a connection with the 1893 World's Fair. And
as was the Shepley, Bullfinch, Rutan, and Coolidge, who were the architects.
Who were the architects of the building that now is the Art Institute. But these people met architects and landscape architects and designers at the World's Fair and brought these ideas back to Wisconsin.
As I look at these homes, I the first thing that comes into my head, because my wife and I are now the proud owners of two homes. We're selling one eventually, and we're restoring another one.
Good luck on both fronts.
Yes,
exactly.
So a cost always comes into my head here, and I'm trying to imagine what it would cost to replicate these homes today.
Well, I think you could probably call Michael Douglas at Villa Louis, or several, or Richard Driehaus at Wadsworth. I'm sure they have an idea. But what we found interesting was many of the original homeowners kept extremely detailed bookkeeping on what everything cost at the time. They were not frivolous.
They also kept inventories of their possessions and of their furnishings. They also, later on in the 20s and the 30s, got excited about motion pictures, and they would often hire a professional to document festivities at their particular home. So there's a lot of information out there. But I think the thing that we'd like to emphasize is that while this is the Historical Society and the Jeffers Foundation, and this is about appreciating and preserving the past, it's also about the fact that today we build in a particular way that isn't meant to replicate the past, but is to represent the time from which we are currently in, our current time. And when these people built their homes, they built homes in a maybe non-consumer way. They built well to last. They didn't build for 7 years.
Yeah, so the building of these, many of these homes took a long, long time to construct.
Well, they took a long time to construct, but the amazing thing at the Fromm Fir Farm in Hamburg, Wisconsin, and at Villa Terrace and several others, the original bathroom fittings are still working. And at the Fromm Fir Farm, we had a Tom Jeffress hosted everybody at Stotts Island for the book launch, and a woman who lives in the Fromm Fir House came up and said to me, I don't know what to do. One of my original light bulbs burned out, and I don't know where to find them. And another homeowner who owns Brasslight Gallery in Milwaukee was standing right there, and Steve said, oh, I can get one for you.
But Steve Konecki, in fact, we talked about there are so many connections between the original owners, but there are a lot of connections between the current owners. The fact that the fellow who heads Brasslight Gallery has probably provided or repaired or reconstituted light fixtures in maybe a dozen of the 20.
Oh, man. So lots of connections. Well, can you tell me about Wingspread a little bit? Because you, Frank Lloyd Wright is represented by Wingspread at Racine, and I'm, you know, why that one and why not one of the other homes?
Well, that's very interesting because we you know, like most architects or designers in Wisconsin, really appreciate Frank Lloyd Wright, but so little was written about Wingspread.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I think Louis can jump in there.
Well, and again, this is one of our favorite homes, but we could have, if we had written a book about Frank Lloyd Wright with 20 of Frank Lloyd Wright homes, it wouldn't have been a complete picture. The way we'd like to have your listeners and our readers think of this book as we're describing the environment and the other architects and the architecture that Frank Lloyd Wright was familiar with when he was growing up in Wisconsin. So we're painting, I think, a very good complement. For those who are interested exclusively in Frank Lloyd Wright, this book gives you one example, and I think we do a very good job of giving it context and background. But what we do an even better job of in the book is painting a picture of the environment from which Frank Lloyd Wright grew and became the great architect that he was.
What, can you give us a little of the backstory on the construction of Wingspread?
Well, for one thing, it has a somewhat checkered history because midway through the construction, Mr. Johnson's wife died, and he considered stopping the project altogether.
And Frank Lloyd Wright convinced him that it would be a healing process for the family?
And for Frank Lloyd Wright, too, right?
Yes, financially healing for him.
Yeah.
But Frank Lloyd Wright had a special affinity for that house. I mean, in many of the books, he is quoted as saying he thought it was his finest house. And we've seen a lot of architecture, you know, not only in Wisconsin but around the world. And I have to admit that 20 years ago when I walked into Wingspread for the first time, I was stopped dead in my tracks. I mean, I could not believe what a beautiful interior volume that building is. It is awesome in the true sense.
Frankly, I thought she was stopped in her tracks because she fell over an Italian architect taking pictures. Because apparently 700 Italian architects...
No, Spanish architects.
Spanish architects. Okay, well, that was this year. It's a wonderful example. But, you know, mm-hmm. part of what we do in these books is that we research them, we visit them, we walk through, we think spatially, but the most important part for us that we try to impart to our readers is that we also draw these buildings. We draw the plans. I sort of get teary-eyed when I talk about it.
Well,
so
I'll jump in.
Have to take over.
he really gets all choked up. But we would encourage the readers to really study the plan of Wingspread in the book.
All the plans.
Well, but to understand Wingspread, you really do have to study the plan, because while the photographs are Zane did a fantastic job, and you know, with the light conditions in there, it's not easy.
No.
But it the photographs do emphasize the vertical. But in the plan, you understand the radiating pinwheel organization. And this was a seminal building where Frank Lloyd Wright was switching from the Western orthogonal into the more non-Western organic. So this was a pivotal building for him. And if you look at his buildings that followed, like the Guggenheim, you begin to understand where he began to study volume and interior volume as opposed to planar architecture.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. I've been enjoying this conversation so much, I've been neglecting our callers here. So let me invite you to join in with your own questions or comments. And the number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And let's take some calls. Ken in Milwaukee, we turn to you. Ken, thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. Say, I wanted to mention that when the two author architects did their book opening announcement here in Milwaukee at Villa Terrace, I was fascinated because I was there and how much information they had shared with us, and the time allotted wasn't enough, and it was something where it could have been a tour through our presentation. Not that they wanted to talk that much, but
we get hoarse.
I enjoyed it very much, and the book also. What I guess I wanted to ask is, because I'm a fan of libraries, and the Milwaukee Public Library has a program every year that they do to teach people how to do house history, and I was wondering, how important were libraries in your research?
Oh, we have a huge debt of gratitude to libraries and to librarians, not only in the state of Wisconsin, but now with the Internet. You know, you can go to the New York Public Library and open a book electronically and scan through pages. But libraries, this book could not have been done without many, many hours in many, many libraries.
A typical example is that when we were looking for the Fromm Fur Farm in Hamburg, we went to the library in Merrill, Wisconsin, which is a beautiful Claude and Stark prairie library. And we got all sorts of information, not only about the fact that Fromm Fur Farm was in Hamburg, not Hamburg, which was 3 miles away, but we were able to find it that way. We also researched, got additional information at the library on background information, and they gave us the address of several supper clubs for dinner that night. But getting back to the library, and you mentioned the Milwaukee Public Library, which has a wonderful archive, the drawings that we have for the Brooke Stevens House were provided for us or to us from that library. Archives have been so helpful. Also, Wisconsin is a great repository. We've got, I think, 71, 72 still extant Carnegie libraries that are magnificent buildings. Some are still libraries, some are not. But we also have the largest concentration of prairie libraries, I think, in any state in the country. But we love librarians because they help us, and we're always exchanging information.
In fact, I have to tell you that the biggest thrill for us personally was going to the library and typing our name in the catalog and seeing it come up in a library. That was a bigger thrill than in a bookstore.
Thank you, Ken. Appreciate the call. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
Let's turn to Dave in Augusta. Dave, hello. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry. One part of my question.
Well, did we lose you?
Did we lose him? I was going to ask you, Larry, where is Augusta?
Augusta is northern Wisconsin. I would say from Madison, it would probably be about 150 miles straight north.
Wow. That we missed.
Okay, like north of Eau Claire?
Yeah.
Okay, Rice Lake?
It's probably 20 miles or so south of Eau Claire.
Well, maybe we should go to it. While we're waiting for him to come back on, can I ask Larry a question?
Sure.
What's your favorite house?
Well, my favorite house in the book?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In the book, let's start with that.
Well, I tell you, the one that was most intriguing to me was the Fromm House.
Oh, okay.
Although I have some affinity for the Octagon House in Watertown. My wife grew up in Watertown, and when she was a teenager, led tours.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, the docent of the Watertown Octagon, when we went.
In fact, just to mention, the book, we did a trial run at Villa Terrace and at Watertown just to check or to sort of confirm our data collection. And Karen, continue with the...
But we did not tell the docent that we were writing a book, and she was so informative and so helpful and so enthusiastic that we knew it was a good idea.
I should also say the Babcock House, I really liked a lot as well.
It's a wonderful house, and Peter Adams, who is the great-grandson of Havilah Babcock, does a far better job than we can. He's so entertaining and knowledgeable and helpful.
We suggest he should go on the speaker route.
Right.
Well, let's go back. We've got Dave from Augusta back.
Okay, great.
Dave, hi.
Hi, good morning. I'm sorry I lost you there. Older homes are a real part of my background. I really love them. I was wondering if you had any American Foursquare homes on the list.
Any American what?
Foursquare.
Foursquare. Well, that's an interesting question.
As a matter of fact, you and several other people have asked us that question, and no, we didn't, but you know, the Victorian, I mean, if you look at Villa Louis, the first floor plan, it's basically a very elaborate foursquare. But we did not have any foursquares.
However, we did, and we were scouting, we found a foursquare in Eau Claire by a very famous architect, Cass Gilbert, who was... a phenomenal architect. The building, in fact, there are two attributed to Cass Gilbert, and I think they were both foursquare and Victorian, and they were very interesting, but they didn't have the backstory, they didn't have a rich site context, and it just didn't make the story this time around.
My wife and I are actually renovating a foursquare home in Madison, so that was an interesting question for me as well. Sandra in Madison wonders, can you name a few places that could have been included if there was space?
Well, look, we started with over 1,500. We ended up inputting 152 into a database that had pictures, had background information, had bibliography, owner, architect. So there are a whole bunch. That would have to be another radio program, Larry.
And here's another email from... Oh, let's see. I can't tell who it's from. But anyway, the person says, I have a two-story miner's cottage in Mineral Point, where Wisconsin began. I grew up in the house, have the original abstract, but have not had any luck finding out the year built. I believe it was about 1855. No luck with the Wisconsin Historical Society. Similar to homes on Shake Rag Alley, approximately 300 yards from the site of the Wisconsin's first legal hanging.
Legal what?
Hanging.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
Well, I don't want to stick my neck out and answer that question.
Well, the question is, how do you find out a date of construction?
Well, especially with that vintage, that's a challenge. There are a couple of different ways, and we'll give you some input from both our sides, but keep in mind, we're architects and landscape architects. The people at the Historical Society are far more adept at that than we are, but you can measure the size of your structural members. Timbers and structural lumber changed in size over the years. But frankly, if he knows it's in the 1850s, I doubt if he's going to get any closer than that. Karen, what would you advise?
Well, the only thing that you can hope for is to find a letter of documentation. But, you know, those sometimes turn up in the strangest places.
You know, part of this book, too, is that we want people like your listener to ask questions like this and start collecting the information.
Because if it weren't for the homeowners themselves, the original homeowners, the records they kept, our work would have been very difficult. And people, some of these people, as I said, kept documents about everything they put in the house. And if anybody is building a house today, please keep your plans in a safe place.
And typically in a black bag.
So in 150 years, somebody can write a story about their house.
I tell you, I had some knew some people who lived in the Columbus area and had a Frank Lloyd Wright home. And
we know which house that is too. Okay.
Well, they found have my facts correct here. They found all the original plans up in the attic.
Oh, yeah. That's not unusual, but also I would imagine the people at Taliesin would have that information. But imagine
better the attic than the basement.
Right. Look, we know of an architect that went searching for a rather famous Milwaukee architect's drawings and found them drying in the basement. His widow, the architect's widow, had just washed all the ink off the linens because she was going to use the linen for something else.
Oh.
But also, imagine living in Columbus and then walking to the Farmers and Merchants Bank down the street, which is the Louis Sullivan Bank. I mean, there's a love. And also, that Sullivan Bank, if you go upstairs, they have their own little museum. They've collected information. And, I mean, that's a very rich example right there.
Isn't it great that in so many of the communities around Wisconsin, that's been done?
And, you know, in addition to the homeowners, the local historic societies are phenomenal in their volunteer efforts,
yes,
most of them, to collect and preserve and make these things available and accessible.
And the person who was thinking about this for a minute, the person who had the home in the Shake Rag Alley area there, might, if he hasn't done so already, might check with the County Register of Deeds.
That's an excellent idea.
They're also, and frankly, we're not all that familiar with it, though we did look for Dodgeville and Mineral Point type homes to put in this. And while there were some that were historically significant, they didn't have, shall we say, the remarkable coefficient that we were looking for.
Well, we were looking for houses that had six criteria, all six criteria, mm-hmm, and that was one way that helped us narrow it down. And otherwise, you know, the list would have been impossible.
Yeah.
Your listener might also see if there are any Sanborn maps for the area.
Sanborn maps.
Right. Those were insurance maps. And since we're talking about an area that basically got its influx or its success from an economic vitality in mining, there may have been mine buildings around it or nearby, and this might have been included in the Sanborn map. There are a whole bunch of, like, our office is right across the street from the Milwaukee Municipal Building, and we go down to their archive. And that's how we got some of the documentation that helped us redraw the elevation for the Pabst Mansion.
Well, I think I've got a kind of a perfect way to end here, because I've got an email from Lisa who says, we had the wonderful chance to do work in the fabulous Babcock home in Neenah. We enjoy everything about it. It's portrayed wonderfully in your book. You did it great justice. It's so nice to see the houses portrayed in a manner that shows the detail and the great lengths people took to build them. A very nice way to, a fitting way, I think, to end our conversation today. I want to thank you both so much for being with us. I've really enjoyed, and I haven't finished your book, I will admit.
Well, Larry, as soon as you're done, we have a 100 question quiz for you. But also, we want to very much thank you and Lisa. That was a great exclamation, a great punctuation to a lovely interview, and thank you for this opportunity.
Yes, and thank you, Larry. You made this very enjoyable.
Karen Connolly and Louis Wasserman of Milwaukee are the authors of Wisconsin's Own, 20 Remarkable Homes, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. I hope you have a chance to look at it. It's a wonderful book. And I hope you have a chance to stay with us, because coming up, we were talking about Zane Williams and the wonderful photography the photos that he took for the book. Well, I'm certainly no Zane Williams. You're probably not a Zane. You may not be Zane Williams caliber either when it comes to photography, but Jack Socha's pretty good, pretty darn good, and he's going to be with us next to talk about photography at this time of the year, taking pictures and digital cameras. That's our topic next year on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.